ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। This is Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 28, entitled Puranjana Becomes a Woman in the Next Life. And today we're on text number 18. Yeah, 18. Lokantaram Gatavati Mayanatha Kutumbini Varatishyate Katham Tvesha Balakan Anushochati. Translation. King Puranjana was anxiously thinking, "Alas, my wife is encumbered by so many children. When I pass from this body, how will she be able to maintain all these family members? Alas, she will be greatly harassed by thoughts of family maintenance." Please repeat. King Puranjana was anxiously thinking, "Alas, my wife is encumbered by so many children. When I pass from this body, how will she be able to maintain all these family members? Alas, she will be greatly harassed by thoughts of family maintenance." Purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. All these thoughts of one's wife indicate that the king was overly engrossed with the thoughts of woman. Generally, a chaste woman becomes a very obedient wife. This causes a husband to become attached to his wife, and consequently he thinks of his wife very much at the time of death. This is a very dangerous situation, as is evident from the life of King Puranjana. If one thinks of his wife instead of Krishna at the time of death, he will certainly not return home back to Godhead, but will be forced to accept the body of a woman and thus begin another chapter of material existence. Lokantaram gatavati mayanatha kutumbini vartishyate katham tvesha balakan anushochati. Lokantaram means into a different life. It also means into a different world, because we don't know where we're coming back. Loka. Loka means society, it means planet, it means world, it means people, it means all these things. And at the time of death, we go into a different one. We begin, as Prabhupada said here, a new chapter of material existence. There's an entertaining story about an Indian, poor Indian villager. Yesterday, the attached Grihastha, the Grihamezi, was described as Dina. Dina means poor. The more assets we have, that is to say, the more assets that we are attached to, the more poor we become. Because, well, when I first went to Haridwar, this was maybe 20 or more, 30 years ago, it was about this time of year. Not particularly warm yet. But I noticed that the local people living there, even though there were patches of snow seen here and there on the ground, they were not wearing shoes. Why? Recently, Indians have learned how to wear socks even. What to speak of shoes. That means that this civilization never really prioritized that sort of interest. If you take a rickshaw, as everyone in this room probably has, from Krishna Balaram Mandir to Loy Bajar, you'll see on the left-hand side, going that way, a billboard that talks about body care, body creations, and shows a nice, happy family comfortably snug in their thermal underwear. This is a relatively new import into this civilization. We can say a lot about that, but the point is that what do you do when you're bereft of your thermal underwear in the winter? What do you do when you're accustomed to wearing shoes and cannot have them? Because here in India, people steal your shoes. Still. This is also part of the traditional culture, it would seem. I once had 5 sets of shoes stolen within the same few days period. But anyway, the point is that as we pander to the body and to the mind, as we make it our priority to ensure that the body is comfortable and that the mind is comfortable. In the West, they have pretty much everything they need for the body, but they don't have everything they need for the mind. People are so anxious. Every once in a while you read about it, some fellow just goes berserk and walks into a school with all sorts of semi-automatic weapons and opens fire on innocent children. It's an insane society. That's another loca. But the point that I'm making is that nunam pramatta kurate vikarma yad indriya pritaya aprinoti. When we become so insanely attached to the material body and the mind and keeping that fragile balance of in place, then what happens when it all disassembles, which it certainly will? It will all disintegrate. It will vaporize in due course of time. This very fragile construction that we have, known as the mind-body complex, that we all enjoy exploiting when we have facility to do so, it works out very well for us for a few years. But then the synapses start to misfire, and you can't remember things anymore. Or you have a blood clot and you cannot move the left side of your body anymore. What do you do then? Or, I mean, back to the mental distresses that we haven't elaborated on, one of your children comes home and announces, I'm gay. Or, I want to marry someone that you don't approve of. These are the miseries of material existence. Everybody has to suffer in one way or another. Of course, it's relative. There's no absolute morality or no absolute ethical standard in this mundane realm. It cannot be, because everything is completely relative in this world. But when we desire to enjoy the 3 modes of material nature, we're given a mind and body, a mundane mind and a mundane body with which to do that. And it's limited by our own doings in the past. What we've done in the past will limit, restrict the amount of assets that we have or the ability that we have to enjoy those things. My mother had a disease called Crohn's disease. It affects your digestion. Jai Shishi Gornitai Shishi Krishna Balaram Lata Vishaka Sahita Shishi Radha Shyama Sundara Kijay. Crohn's disease means that you can absorb whatever you eat, you can taste it fine, but your body cannot absorb the nutrition from it. So it doesn't really work. And it makes life very miserable in other ways as well. But that's just one of the many possibilities that we have to look forward to if we make it to old age, which we may not. But even if you make it into old age and pass beyond old age, then you've got this scenario. Lokantaram gatavati. So I was going to say, there's a story about a poor Indian farmer. And someone told him about the glories of America. Here in India, you get a very perverse misrepresentation of what America is. People would think that in America the streets are paved with gold. You need to go to Camden, near outside of Philadelphia, and see that even the police won't go there. The whole place is desolate. It is a perfect example of the carcinogenic expansion of urban development that leaves entire city blocks devastated, empty, devoid of all forms of life. Through the mad, greedy, frenetic development of the type that we see right here in Vrindavan Dham, which is to build and develop more and more and more in order to facilitate a few people's greed. But so someone told him about, someone gave him the Indian version of America, what it's like there. So he got very agitated to go there. And in fact, an astrologer, he went one day to see if it's really feasible. The astrologer said, certainly, you're going to take your next birth in America. And he got very excited. He said, he went on to describe, you're going to be driven around in a chauffeured car. You're going to get 3 meals a day. You're going to live in a mansion in Beverly Hills. And you're going to be surrounded by beautiful young women who adore you. And so he was completely excited about this. And then the astrologer added, because you're going to be a toy poodle. Everybody knows what a toy poodle is. If you have visited Los Angeles, you've seen, virtually it seems everyone has a small dog that they keep very carefully, and in effect they worship it. As a matter of fact, I actually heard this news report. In Israel, there's a new television show on television that actually is aimed only at people's dogs. All the cast, all the characters in this television series, they're canine. There are no humans in the whole picture. The implication is that some attached householder, insanely attached to the dog, is bringing the dog and sitting the dog in front of the television set where the dog can watch other dogs doing what dogs do. So, lokantaram gataveti. We may have to go into some form that we don't necessarily appreciate. And we will get the result of all of our good karma, but it's almost never in the way that we expect. Has anyone experienced this? If you get old enough, you will. Because everyone does experience this. Life does not turn out the way you plan or the way you expect, in most cases. You lose what you are attached to. There are 3 things, Tamal Krishna Goswami used to say very eloquently. 3 things can happen with regards to sense gratification in this world. Number 1, you cannot have what you want. And that's going to happen to about 95% of the population in this world. Because according to recent scientific studies, it would require the additional resources of 5 extra planet Earths in order to facilitate the intentions of the present-day world population. Wherein, roughly 5% of the world population controls and exploits more than 50% of the resources. So you can't have what you want. That's one option. The other option is that you can have what you want, but eventually you realize that it's actually just, it's not everything that it was cracked up to be. It's not everything that they said it would be. Just like the farmer who comes to America and, well, I'll tell you a graphic story. One of our life members in Dallas was watching television one day, night, about 10 p.m. He didn't realize that in America you don't open your door at that hour. So when someone knocked at the door, the first and last thing he saw was the explosion coming out of the end of a gun, right in his face. He was killed on the spot. So that was the shattering of his dream, and he went on to another loka. But at any rate, the idea is that you may get what you want, you may get what you asked for. Be careful what you ask for when you come and pray in the temple, because you may get it. Be very careful. If you're asking for something temporary, you're going to get something temporary. And temporary means you're going to lose it. So that's the third option. You can never get what you want. You can get what you want and find out that it's really not as good as you thought it would be. Or you can get what you want and you also like it, but then it's taken away from you. Because everything in this world is taken away from us. all of our loved ones, these are the things being listed here. The family, Kutumbini, the wife, the children, all of them, and it goes on, according to Sridhar Swami, who comments on this verse. The next four verses are elaborating on the lamentation of Puranjana at the time of death. Now, there is a problem here. Yesterday we heard that King Puranjana was overly attached to his family and conceptions of I and mine. Because he was overly attracted to his wife, he was already quite poverty-stricken. We've described that already. Not just the wife, but anything that she facilitates. Women like men, because men represent bhoga to the women. They can give everything. They supply. It's a wonderful opportunity, isn't it? And in exactly the same way, for the man, the woman is the source of all material enjoyment, as it were. So that works out fine when the karma is good. But when the karma runs out, or when the time of death happens, and we're not ready to process that literally life-shattering event, then we have to suffer, and that's been stated yesterday. Tadhyau pramadaya dino viprayoga upasthite. He was already quite poverty-stricken, and at the time of separation, he became very sorry. Bhaktivedanta Thakur has also sung about this. Now, we heard yesterday an unabashed glorification of the grihastha ashram, as if there was really no other option. In the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the nature of something which is good and something which is bad has been defined. And particularly with respect to our situation within the social order known as Varnashram Dharma. There Krishna tells Uddhava, Sve sve adhikare ya nishtha sa guna parikirtitaha. Which is to say that when a person is situated exactly according to his or her adhikar, exactly, adhikar is another word that it's hard to translate. It means prerogative. What you're allowed to do, but also what you're capable of doing. When you're situated exactly according to your adhikar, or as he said yesterday, doing what you want to do for Krishna, then that is considered to be a qualification, in terms of karma, at least, in terms of dharma. Because dharma and karma are synonymous. They mean the same thing. Strictly speaking, any activity, or karma in general means activity also, but any activity which is not dharma, that's called papa, or vikarma. And there's no such thing as vikarma yoga. Keep it in mind. There's no such thing. We do have to keep this in mind. Because most of us don't have a clear enough conception of what dharma means to be able to understand the implications of this principle that there's no such thing as vikarma yoga. You cannot employ vikarma in Krishna's service, and the definition of vikarma is anything which is not in the shastric paradigm. Anything which is not dharma, as enjoined in the Shastra, that is by default, vikarnama. Now, this is a problem for those of us in the modern day and age because virtually everything that we do is vikarnama. And we don't even realize it yet. Yet. But lokantaram gatavati. At the time that we leave the body, then we may have a rude awakening. And this is a problem that we all have to deal with. But at any rate, it's considered to be guna, a qualification to be able to do exactly what you're able to do and not attempt more than you can do. That's what we call the Peter principle. And neither settle less with what you can do. So there are actually four ashrams. And there are four varnas as well. And a person must move progressively. We heard that it's nowhere stated that one has to give up the household ashram, which is, it's simply an incorrect statement. Because the injunction is many, many times stated throughout Srila Prabhupada's books. For example, if we go back two chapters to text number 11, we will see what Prabhupada has reminded us of in his purport there. He says, that maybe it's not text 11. Anyway, you can find them yourself by reading this very narration. There are enough statements that encourage us that one has to at least move into the Vanaprastha ashram at some point, especially after 50. It is explicitly stated, Pancha Sordhvam Vanam Vrajet. So sometimes we hear things that are simply incorrect, but the point is that a person should not squander his adhikar. If someone has the adhikar to actually act as a bona fide brahmachari, or better yet, sannyasi, then he must do that. It's in the best interest of the society. Because otherwise there's an imbalance created. And one's own advancement is checked, as was the intention behind yesterday's verse, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Now, that acharya, he has linked these verses together, today's verse and the last few verses, actually, from 16 through 18. And he makes some very interesting comments in this connection. He says, marana kale jivasya stri putradinam eva smaranam sambhavati natu buddhi vivekadinam iti kechid ahuhu. Some people say that there's possibility at the time of death that one will not think, will not be able to maintain his discrimination, his intelligence, which we have received from the spiritual master, from the parampara, from the shastra. There's every possibility that one will not be able to maintain that. In fact, there's every probability that one will not be able to maintain that. And instead, sriputradinam smaranam. The jiva will have this, he will think of his wife, he will think of the children, he'll think of the house, all these bank balance, adi, 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 adi. So that's one thing. And then he also says, anyetu dharma bhavati buddhireva puranjanitvena purava prastuteityato mrityu samaye dharma buddhya vichedo buddhyantarena sanyoga. So, on the other hand, we've also heard previously in this very narration that the wife of King Puranjana, Puranjani, what does she represent? Who remembers? Spiritual intelligence, dharmic intelligence. He states it here as dharmavati buddhi. So we have a conflict here. It seems that on one hand, the wife is, in yesterday's verse, described as pramada, that thing that makes you go insane. Pramada means insane, thing that makes you mad. And on the other hand, we've previously heard that she's called Dharmavati Buddhi. So what are we supposed to make from this? He gives us both, he doesn't take any particular side in this. But it's relative to one's individual adhikar. This is the point. Whether the wife is a hindrance, for some persons a wife is a hindrance, even a good wife. How so? It is the nature of dharma that it creates antithetical situations. How so? For example, Prabhupada stated here that it's the duty of a wife, or a chaste wife at least, will be obedient and submissive to her husband, always thinking of him. Here it's described here, and I'll just go ahead for a moment because it's quoted in today's verse as well. In the purport, at least. King Puranjana began to think of his past dealings with his wife. He recalled that his wife would not take her dinner until he had finished his. She would not take her bath until he had finished his. And that she was always very much attached to him, so much so that if he would sometimes become angry or chastise her, she would simply remain silent and tolerate his misbehavior. He continued thinking how he was in a state of bewilderment. When he was in a state of bewilderment, his wife would give him good counsel, and how she would become aggrieved when he was away from home. In so many ways, he's thinking like this. A wife in particular, well, not in particular, everyone in general, but a wife especially, it's obvious, is highly encouraged in the system of dharma to become dependent, to become submissive, to become devoted. In fact, so much so that there's no difference between the word that is used for the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the word that is used for one's husband, pati. They're the same thing. And therefore Krishna can tell us in the ninth canto that in exactly the same way that a chaste wife brings her husband under control, in that way my devotees conquer me. So it's an antithetical situation, because although this spirit in a wife, it obliges the husband so much, and it increases the husband's attachment so much that he has difficulty thinking of Krishna at the time of death. And similarly, at the time of death, the wife is put into a very sorry state, which is why King Puranjan can worry like this. Having cultivated, consciously, deliberately, according to the authority of Shastra, an attitude of complete dependence, now she has to fend for herself. See how dharma creates so many problems? Therefore, people give it up. I mean, we don't really have this problem so much in the modern society, because women have figured out that they've got to take care of themselves. Everybody knows this. This is why democracy is popular. Democracy is not popular because it works, neither because it's fair. It's popular because it gives people the impression that they're taking care of themselves, when in fact they're not. We know from Bhagavad Gita. Everything is already written on your forehead. Whatever is going to, suffering or enjoyment, is whatever you're going to get, it's already written. And according to the interactions of the three modes of material nature, everything is affected in due course of time. So it seems like dharma is a big problem. And not only that, but it's unappealing, because our senses and our minds, they naturally want to enjoy unmitigated sense gratification, unrestricted sense gratification, and dharma puts a check on that. If you can find a common denominator amongst all the staggering variety of dharmic options that are available in the human form of life relative to your adhikar, all the different disciplines you can follow, all the different ashram duties and varna duties and sadharana dharma, ordinary duties that we have. And then on top of that, there's emergency dharma called atadharma. So many different kinds of dharma. It's as bewildering as the facade of a South Indian temple. You see all this wonderful variety manifest in multicolors there. I live down the street from a Tamil temple, that's why I know. But anyway, all this this variety of dharma is meant to produce an attitude of dependence, an attitude of submission in everyone, regardless of the station. Women and shudras, it's particularly obvious because they're at the base level of the social order in terms of karmic facility, we can say, karmic expansion. So it causes problems. Even for spiritual life, it causes problems. What to speak of for sinful life? We're perhaps more acquainted with the frustration. The common denominator of all this variety is frustration of your limitless material desires to exploit Krishna's energies. That is the common denominator. It is intended to frustrate you. So if marriage doesn't work, it's because it does work for that purpose. It works to frustrate you only. And everything else is of the same way. One is intended to come to the realization that there's no point in all of this. And that's even before we realize that any moral principles in this mundane realm, in this what we call Trigunya realm, it's all relative. It has no meaning. It's according to context. This is not existentialist philosophy. This is Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, wherein Krishna describes this to Uddhava very clearly. So we actually have no argument with those moral relativists who say that everything is, you know, there's no absolute, the only absolute is that there's no absolute truth. Well, that is true, absolutely. But it's absolute truth at the same time. Therefore, there's a story. There's a king. And he had his minister. And The king was describing how much he hated, what was it? He didn't like eggplant. What was, let me see if I can remember the details of the story. I think it was the minister who told the king that, you know, this eggplant is a lousy vegetable, and you should not eat eggplant. Some people don't eat eggplants. Or any other nightshade vegetable. They're considered to be unhealthy in Ayurveda, at least in Shakavamsi Ayurveda. But, so the king became convinced that eggplant is not, it's a nasty vegetable, he shouldn't eat it anymore. Then another vaidya came and told the king about all the virtues of eggplant. So this very minister who was, when the king said he didn't want to eat eggplant, his minister was saying, yes, yes, you should not eat eggplant. It's a terrible vegetable. Anybody in his right mind will not eat eggplant. Adi, adi, adi. In this way, he's going on and on. Whatever the king is saying, he's repeating that. Then another vaidya came and convinced the king that actually eggplant is the most healthy vegetable. Especially in the West now, we have so many theories about medicine and what works and what doesn't work. Everybody's got their own spin on this. We'll give you advice gratis about what to do to maintain your health. So then the king became convinced in that way, and then at that point he talked to the minister about it, and the minister said, oh, absolutely, you're correct. There's no doubt about it. The eggplant is the only thing that, I mean, you have to eat eggplants. There's just no doubt about it. So the king said, well, wait a minute, just a few days ago you were telling me that this eggplant is a lousy vegetable, and have you completely reversed your position now? What's going on? So what did the minister say? He said, Maharaj, I work for you. I don't work for the eggplant. This is the Indian conception of dharma. It does not require consistency. Because there is no consistency in this world. In a world where everything is temporary, there cannot be consistency. That's why our acharyas say, na dharmam na dharmam. I don't care about dharma, and I don't care about adharma either. Because Krishna consciousness lifts you out of this trigunya paradigm also, as Arjuna was instructed in Bhagavad Gita. Nistrigunya bhava, Krishna says, early on. When he's talking about karma yoga, in fact. So in Krishna consciousness, although the substrate of healthy development of Krishna consciousness is dharma and only dharma, that's an important point to note. This is on the authority of Vishnu Purana. There is no way for an ordinary person to come to pure devotional service except through the path of dharma. He will not be receptive before then. Although theoretically it's possible, practically Krishna tells us at the end of chapter 7, that unless he's situated in piety, he's not going to sustain this effort of pure devotional service. It's not going to be comfortable for him, and he'll give it up. And that's why later on he also reminds us that out of thousands of people who try, hardly one really fixes. And of those who are fixed in this path, hardly one really attains perfection. It's not easy. But dharma, although it's the substrate or the point of access to Krishna consciousness, at the same time, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says, dharma is the root of all cheating. It's the root of all cheating. Any Indian should know this. The way you cheat in India is through dharma, not through anything else. By following dharma. This is why we find extreme obsequious behavior when we're bribing even gods are bribed here according to the system of dharma, according to this concept of dharma. But this is the idea that explains why there's no absolute truth within relative existence any more than there can be real substance in one's dream. So one has to come out of the dream, and Lord Shiva, it said in the Padyavali of Srila Rupa Goswami, he's a perfect example of a Vaishnava who's completely transcendental. Yesterday we had Shivaratri, so it's a nice reflection we can share. That Shiva, on the one hand, he's accepting the moon on his crown, and the moon is emanating nectar for all living beings. Something nice, something bhadra. And on the other hand, Lord Shiva is also garlanded with what? Snakes. And snakes are emanating visha, poison. Something which is abhadra. So this calculation of bhadra and abhadra, it has no relevance for a great soul, for a Vaishnava in particular. And Lord Shiva is the greatest of the Vaishnavas. Vaishnavanam yatha shambhu. He, without discrimination, he bears both of them. Because he's engaging them in Krishna's service. And this is the difficult thing about Krishna consciousness. Because although we come in through the door of dharma, ultimately, Krishna says, sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam vraja. We have to give that up in the interest of surrender. And ultimately, if there is an absolute principle that permeates even mundane dharma in this world, it is this thing only. I mentioned earlier, it is always going to instill a sense of submission and dependence and elevation of the spirit towards this ideal of pure devotional service. If it's carried out progressively, at least. Therefore, we also call it Sanatana Dharma, or Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls it Jaiva Dharma, or Srimad Bhagavatam calls it Param Dharma, Paro Dharma. Savai Pungsam Paro Dharma, Yato Bhaktira Dhokshije. This is the idea. While we have this human form of life, and especially in the Kali Yuga, we are going to fail at every mundane interest that we may pursue. It's going to fail. Zarur. Guaranteed. But this thing we can focus our energies on through simply chanting this Yuga Dharma, which is called Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. And cultivating the spirit which is at the core of any of its mundane and temporary manifestations in the form of infinite varieties of dharma. Therefore it's called Parodharma. Harinama Sankirtana, particularly in this age, but devotional service in general, in all ages, it's our Sanatana Dharma. It's what we really are. And although it causes problems in the material existence, even when you are engaged in piety, that very piety produces an arthas that causes us suffering. Still we cannot give it up because we're so ordered. As a function of devotional service, we have to follow our dharmas in this world. And it seems to me, at least, that this is the spirit with which Srila Prabhupada told us that the remaining 50% of his mission is this Varnashram Dharma in particular. Because we live in a very pungent and caustic, antithetical social system that makes even the basic practice of chanting Hare Krishna very difficult. Have you noticed? If you live in the West, you've certainly noticed. But even in India, things are getting very, very difficult in this way. Anyway, there's much we can say about that, but we're running out of time, so these are just a few things. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his purport, he also sums it up here. The point is that one should develop a mentality, and that mentality is mamadhunapi dharmacharane triptir najata kim karomi maranam upasthitam. Now I'm at the point of death. We're going back to the point which was made earlier that Puranjani, the queen of King Puranjana, she actually represents the spiritual intelligence. And so at the time of death, a person actually can maintain his attachment to this wife, spiritual intelligence. And he should think that I'm not really developed that much in my Krishna consciousness, and yet now it's time for me to die. What am I going to do? Before we reach that point, we have to cultivate it now. That's the point. So there's a positive interpretation of this verse, and there's also the negative interpretation. The negative interpretation is that it's every probability that we will remember our mundane attachments to our family members. Because, make no mistake, it is a mundane attachment that led you to those family members. That should not be ignored, as it sometimes is. But on the other hand, if we take it that our spiritual intelligence, if we understand this particular narration at least, to refer to Puranjani as the spiritual intelligence, then one can also definitely think of that wife at the time of death. One should remember all the instructions of the spiritual master, and hopefully after a lifetime of having followed all those instructions. My godbrother Adikarta Prabhu the other day very nicely stated, we have to follow all the instructions of Srila Prabhupada. And Srila Prabhupada himself also said this, even the little ones. They're there to help us only. They're not there to frustrate us, even though they do frustrate what we think we are. They're actually meant to bring us to our eternal life. So, Sri Guru Charana Padma Kevala Bhakti Sadma. The only place you're ever going to find pure Krishna consciousness is in the left and right foot, of lotus foot of the spiritual master. That's where it stays, nowhere else. I'll stop here. Does anybody have any questions or comments on any of these points? Yes, Prabhuji.
Krishna consciousness is only sustained in a pious background. So I wanted to know, in Bhagavatam, with the Vishnu Dutas himself, they themselves speak about the glories of the holy name, and they say that just like a medicine, even if unknowingly taken, it acts. So many times the classes I've heard that we have to chant attentively, and we should. But what about those mantras which the mind is flickering and goes to so many thoughts, sinful and pious or whatever. So those Hare Krishna Mahamantra which we are not able to hear, that Hare Krishna Mahamantra, will it destroy sinful reactions which are in the form of sinful desires, or will it not?
Are you talking about offensive chanting, or are you talking about chanting that is sincere but immature?
Yeah. I would say that we are trying to chant. I am trying to chant, but the mind goes to various impressions. How should I take it? It's like things are getting cleared off, or sometimes it feels that it is like...
It takes some time. Yeah. According to the Acharyas, when we are in the clearing stage, we may still be chanting offensively, but it's called namabhasa. And even namabhasa can nullify sinful reactions. So one can be purified as long as one is sincere, but if one is deliberately chanting in order to nullify sinful reactions, then that is an offense. So the point is that, therefore, Srila Prabhupada often stressed two things, to be serious and to be sincere, because that is really the key to all advancement in this age. Another way of putting it is honesty. The bull of dharma in this age is standing only on one remaining leg, which is truthfulness. And to be sincere means to be truthful. To be insincere means to be duplicit. So if we're chanting sincerely for the purpose of purification, for Krishna's pleasure, then we will become purified by that chanting. And if we are not chanting in that way, especially if we're chanting in an offensive manner, we'll also become purified after a long, long, long time. How long? Thousands of births, potentially. It depends on us. Does that answer your question? So similarly, it's a mixed picture here. We've heard that the attachment for the wife is a great danger. At the time of death, one may be distracted. That's if one sees the wife as separate from Krishna consciousness. Unfortunately, most of us do. And it's, you know, in some ways we have a Krishna conscious life, but in some ways that grihastha life is not Krishna conscious. There's some speck of material attachment will almost always be there. We have to recognize that. Yesterday we heard that a more advanced person will do what he wants to do for Krishna rather than what Krishna wants him to do. That's more advanced in the sense that karma is considered to be more advanced than vikarma. But it's not more advanced in the sense that it's not full surrender. So that should be noted as well. So these all tie together, these points. Is that clear? Satisfied? Any other questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu.
I as you stated that manushanam sahasreshu, that sloka, like how many out of thousands only one takes up to properly to the process. So, but it is also stated how it is susukam kartumavyam. So can you please clarify this thing?
Well, this is described at length in some of the most important verses of the Bhagavad Gita, which are in chapter 7, texts 15 and 16. There are elaborate commentaries on those verses by Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, Baladeva Vidyabhushan, and also Srila Prabhupada's purports bring out the essence of these commentaries. The point is that we come to devotional service with some motives. Everybody has their hetu. Hetu means a motive or a reason to perform devotional service. And in general, in the very beginning, that reason cannot be pure because we're thoroughly impure. Entry-level Krishna consciousness means self-motivated Krishna consciousness. So that's understood. And devotional service is pleasing because it's not pungent activity. It is also considered to be pious activity of a sort. But we don't get the full benefit of that devotional service until our hearts are actually purified and we engage without conditions, without motivations. So that's why a person, even me, he may enjoy Krishna consciousness for now, but once he or she finally figures out that I'm not going to get what I want here, because what I want is something mundane, then he leaves, or she leaves. And that's how it works. They're happy, they're dancing, everything is great for a few years. But Prabhupada said, without knowledge, you cannot perform this voluntary tapasya. And without actually acting on that knowledge in the form of preaching Krishna consciousness, then eventually there's no more Hari Hari Bol. Prabhupada said these things. Is that clear? People come with motives and Krishna will fulfill their motives, but then when they get their desires fulfilled, then they're gone because they actually wanted something other than Krishna. It's like Prabhupada said that this is, you know, the communists used to hand out bread and say, you're praying to God for your daily bread and he's not giving you anything, but we're giving you all the bread in the world. So Prabhupada said, this is not love of God, this is love of bread. That's the point. Okay, so we'll stop here. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.